Welcome to The Riff, where writer and investor Bern Hobart and I discuss the major inflection points caused by technological change. Our weekly conversation covers the obvious and not so obvious ways in which markets and businesses will adapt as a result. Let's jump right in.
So there's a number of interesting things you wrote about. First, let's start with e-commerce roll-ups and what they illustrate about the Amazon model.
Yeah, so there was this trend that was happening in the late 2010s and really accelerated in 2020 through roughly 2022 of companies acquiring small Amazon sellers and just putting them together and trying to operate them better. And what those companies, their pitch was basically, these Amazon sellers, they're small businesses. They have all of the usual management issues that a small business might have. And so we can, you know, we've done this before. We know a lot about Amazon and the system. We have our checklist and everything, so we can run them better. And that was part of the pitch. I thought the simpler pitch was just this pure diversification bet of, if you have one company that's dependent on one product, of course, it should sell at a pretty low multiple of cash flow. But if you have a portfolio of 100 companies that are each one product companies, and one of them can be doing well, one of them is doing badly, and maybe the ones that are doing well use their cash flow to subsidize the new emerging ones, et cetera, like, that seems like it should deserve a higher multiple. So you do get this pure like economic free lunch of the person selling is selling an undiversified bet, and the person who's buying is buying into an organization that is an increasingly diversified one. And it didn't really work, because it turns out, among other things, a lot of the Amazon sellers, like, they were actually reasonably good at what they were doing. They were reasonably crafty people. Like, there's a reason that they're doing millions or tens of millions a year on Amazon and other people aren't. So some of those improvements were kind of hard to come by. And also, a lot of these companies just really bought into extrapolating the increase in e-commerce spending that started in 2020 during the pandemic. And just, you know, if you extrapolate that forward a couple of years, you get some really good numbers. But if you decide that what actually happens is, no, everyone who bought an air fryer in 2020, the vast majority of them would have bought it in 21 or 22 or 23, but now they already have one. So actually sales go down in the future, demand has been pulled forward, then buying a bunch of those companies, even if you're paying a low multiple, if it's a low multiple of high, artificially higher earnings, then it's not going to work out well. So some of those companies have gone under, some of them are actually rolling one another up. But I think the other thing to think about with this business is, like, from Amazon's perspective, it really shouldn't exist. Amazon does not want there to be a better way to run an Amazon retailer where you game the system better, because it's either a zero-sum game of, okay, you figured out how to put the right keywords into your product name and somebody else didn't, so you get the traffic and they don't. And, you know, no one really wins or loses in that scenario. Like, in the aggregate, no one wins or loses. It's just you're changing who the winner of that fixed pie is. So in that case, like, Amazon doesn't want that to be a super valuable business. They'd like that to be as commoditized as possible. But also, if there is an actual operating improvement you can make, if there is some problem that a lot of small sellers have, whether it's like bad inventory management or suboptimal marketing, or they could be pricing differently and more profitably, Amazon wants individual sellers to be able to do that, because if Amazon provides tools to do that and everybody does it, then Amazon captures a lot of the upside. So if there's something that every retailer can do that gives them an extra point of gross margin, if every Amazon seller does that, then Amazon just raises their prices, like raises their cut by 1%. The retailers were happy before, or, you know, satisfied enough before, they're satisfied now, Amazon gets a little bit of extra money. And so you can view a lot of the things that Amazon does for sellers as efforts to commoditize selling. And so stuff like, they, you know, they of course have had reviews for a long time, but they've started using generative AI to slurp up a bunch of reviews and then create this plain text summary. And because they have just tons and tons of first party purchase data from individual users, they can actually figure out what part of the review would actually help you make a better decision, where better probably means you buy it, but better could mean you don't buy that. You buy some other variant of the product that better suits your specific needs. So that's the kind of thing that does increase, like, the utility of Amazon as a platform. It makes the company more profitable, but it also eliminates some job for third-party companies. And in my very early career, I spent some time in the online marketing and SEO space. And after a while, I became really conscious of the fact that if search engine optimization works as this scalable marketing tool, if you can use it to, you pay someone and you get search traffic, that directly competes with Google. Like, that is money out of their pocket, because if that number one organic ranking could be an ad slot instead, then Google gets the money and not me. So, and obviously Google wants that. Like, they have to view the entire industry of manipulating the search engine as some combination of a continuing headwind to quality, to the extent that the best site gets outranked by the site with the best SEO, or if all the sites have equally good SEO and they've commoditized it, then the SEO is just competing with their, with Google search ads. So there's a very direct economic incentive for any platform to destroy a business that is dedicated to optimizing performance on that platform. One way or another, it's either an actual cost to the platform or it's an opportunity cost to the platform. And either way, it tends to go away. So it turns out that when you're comparing different management skills, the relevant comparison is not this question of, Razor or whatever, are they way better at running an e-commerce store than the median Amazon seller? No, the question is Amazon better at e-commerce than those guys? And does Amazon have more resources and more data? And is Amazon more relentless about getting every last basis point of margin? And the answer to that in almost every case is yes, Amazon cares more, and Amazon is better at that kind of ruthless competition. So it kind of made sense to me when they were growing that they would exist. And then as they started to decline, it made an increasing amount of sense to me that this is not a business that actually, like, it's a business that can be durable only if the platform is not fully optimizing, which in the end means it can exist, but it can exist as this sort of antitrust play where if Amazon actually gets in trouble for being so good at commoditizing Amazon selling that the only way you compete is based on the product and not based on anything else, then maybe there's some kind of antitrust argument there, especially if the result of that is always that Amazon's margins go up. But until then doesn't really work as a long-term business. And it's tough to bet your entire business on a hypothetical change in regulatory priorities sometime in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting. Chris Dixon has written and talked a lot about how this idea that big platforms are incentivized to work with other developers or providers early on to sort of build the inventory. But then once they get much bigger, then they're optimized to just squeeze every last, sort of bit of it for themselves. And it's interesting to think about how that works on the user side as well, just kind of the adverse incentives of platforms as they reach scale.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a cycle that makes a lot of sense, that companies want to be open early on, especially if they have a good product, because the more open they are, the more they increase their surface area. And then eventually, yeah, they get to the point where they can close things off, they can capture all of the benefit, and then that's exactly what they want to do. So you can see that with someone like Facebook, where they realize that when they opened up their platform, their basic part of their strategy there, I think, was if Yelp is tightly integrated and Zynga is tightly integrated and everybody who wants to in some way leverage social connections is tightly integrated to Facebook, then they are constantly running Facebook ads. They're constantly running de facto Facebook ads on every page of every site that they use. So that's really good for Facebook. But then you reach a point where A, the people who are really good at manipulating the platform get pretty spammy. I think Zynga talked to Mark Pincus talked about this at one point, that Zynga was responsible. I think his line was something like they were 10% of revenue and like 35 or some crazy percentage of API calls on Facebook. So like a lot of the activity on that platform was just people spamming their friends to ask for strawberries in Farmville and not anything really substantial or especially interesting. And so Facebook, of course, cracked down on that. But then you can look at the evolution of Reels is actually a really interesting one, where early on Facebook just, they needed inventory. They needed to be able to show people videos on Reels. They had exactly the problem that TikTok had, and they solved it in exactly the same way economically. The accounting is different, but like the TikTok's problem early on was just there's not enough content to keep people on the platform. Therefore, we don't get enough data from them to figure out what to show them, so they all churn out. But there is a solution to that, which is just you spend billions of dollars on Facebook ads, you get tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people to sign up, and some fraction of them will be on the platform long enough to get addicted. They start sharing things on Facebook and all of the videos that they share on Facebook, and with the TikTok logo and the screen name of the person who posted it. So you sort of buy your way into the distribution that gets you the data advantage that allows you to grow more organically. And then Facebook did the same thing, where they basically gave up a lot of inventory that would otherwise be for more like organically deserving content or just for ads. And they gave it to Reels instead. Reels was a big headwind when they were rolling it out. And early on, Reels was primarily just things people posted to Instagram or things people posted to TikTok that Facebook paid them to repost to Reels. So it was like, very early on, it was this kind of humiliating product for Facebook, where all the really viral videos would end with their competitor's logo and this acknowledgement that this is actually not a Facebook thing at all. But now they've actually reached some kind of critical mass where they've stopped breaking out the Reels financial impact on Facebook. And they've said that it's pretty much, you know, approaching parity and is just another product in the mix or another feature in the mix. And now most of the content does seem to be organic, and they've just, you know, through brute force and through spending billions in opportunity costs, they've gotten a good enough model that they can actually recommend videos people want to see.
We'll get back to the conversation in a moment after a word from our sponsors. Hey everyone, Eric here. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from our AI and investing cluster of podcasts to shows that drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, investors, and influencers, like Econ 102 with Noah Smith. We're launching new shows every week, and we're looking for industry-leading sponsors. If you think that might be you and your company, email me at ericaturpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K at turpentine.co, and let's partner together. The tech world turns to the Brave browser for its unbeatable privacy protections. But did you know that Brave also has a private ad platform? Brave Ads offers first-party targeting, and it's been cookie-less since day one, so you can relax while third-party tracking cookies disappear from the web. Today, millions of people turn to ad blockers to avoid being tracked and pestered online. But Brave's new ad model aligns incentives for users and advertisers. Users earn rewards for viewing ads, which they can save, spend, or pass along to their favorite creators. And advertisers score points for respecting user privacy, generating ROI without invasive tracking. So whether it's high-impact announcements on the new tab page or keyword-targeted ads in Brave Search, Brave offers diverse, private, future-proof ad formats for all your business goals. Join the future of advertising at brave.com/ads. Mention MOZ when signing up for a 25% discount on your first campaign.
Let's stay on big platforms for a minute. Why will moderation problems never end?
Yeah, so this was a fun one. I think it has been, it sort of felt for a while like companies, when they start out with some platform where users can talk to another, like really early on, you don't have moderation platforms because you don't have moderation problems because all of your users pretty much know each other, and they probably are on the platform because you told them that you started this cool website and they should check it out. So you don't really have to worry about them doing really unacceptable or illegal things in the same way that you just don't have to mostly worry about your friends doing something really unacceptable and egregious. Like there's social shame is enough to tamp that down. And then as they grow, the free-for-all approach becomes harder and people start pushing those boundaries, and you have all sorts of external scandals where someone will say, like, you can't believe all this crazy stuff that's being posted on Reddit. And then you have internal scandals where Reddit can't believe that you banned this thriving, wonderful community that was pro-social and just, you know, devoted to something creepy or disgusting or horrible or whatever. So you have these backs and forths. And what I realized was that over time, you just end up having to draw this really, really detailed boundary between what is allowed and what's not allowed. And every time you add some detail to that boundary, you create a bunch of analogies to things where it looked like this was not acceptable, but hey, if you're allowing X, Y is sort of like X. So why don't you unban Y? And so the debate actually ends up becoming more and more absorbing. And there's also just the superlinear risk scaling factor where if someone does something bad on Reddit, for example, it is partially notable because they did something bad, but it's also notable because it's associated with this really well-known brand, Reddit. So it actually becomes more newsworthy as the site gets bigger. And just if the site is a representative slice of the human population, you 10x the size, you 10x the number of psychos. And so you actually more than 10x the number of news stories about those psychos. So for a while, it's just really, really painful for them to deal with. And it that that just never ends. There's always going to be this debate over what should be allowed, what should not be allowed. People will always have different priors. And if you create a site where they can all interact with one another, they will all want to argue about that stuff. So the solution that a lot of these companies end up imposing, sometimes they're explicit about it, sometimes it's kind of implicit, is they just try not to make the really controversial stuff as prominent. So it used to be that on Reddit, the the Donald subreddit was really, really was frequently showing up on the front page. And it was because a lot of users in that subreddit, like the culture of that subreddit was you upvote everything so it'll get on the front page and troll the median Reddit user. And Reddit had to tweak their algorithm to make that less common. But they actually had a kind of similar issue probably in the late 2000s, like maybe early 2010s, but more late 2000s, where the atheism subreddit was really big, really obnoxious. It didn't have the same culture of trying to manipulate the homepage explicitly, but like if you went to Reddit early on, it did seem like this just evangelical atheist site that was for a very, very particular, very nerdy subculture. But it was like a subculture of nerds within the broader nerd subculture. And I'm not entirely sure what they did about that. It could just be that online atheism had, you know, this huge growth spurt in the 2000s, and then everyone just managed to lose interest in that, or decided that, hey, we haven't actually resolved the debate over which religion is right over the last, you know, 3,000 years of recorded human history. It's like, it's a pretty consistent problem throughout human history that people disagree on these things. So maybe we should argue about something else. But either way, like the actual solution to a lot of moderation problems is just try to make it really hard for users to talk about politics, or try to make it so they're only talking about politics with people who completely agree with them, such that when they do have disputes, the disputes are just so tedious to everyone else that it is not worth reading. Like if you read intra-libertarian disputes on who's the real libertarian, who's a statist, who's a psycho, or the intra-Marxist disputes on like who is actually Marxist, who is a fake Marxist, whatever, who is secretly a liberal, and not a Marxist at all, who's actually an anarchist. Like those are also incredibly tedious to read. And so as long as you put all of the self-described Marxists and libertarians in their own Marxist or libertarian box where they can argue with each other to their heart's content, like anyone who glances in the box just doesn't want to spend any time looking in the box. The box is just, they're going to set it aside. And so you end up with a main feed, a homepage, whatever, that is lots of cute animal videos and, you know, funny jokes and stuff like that. Or it's customized to your interests, and it's customized to your interests minus the argument-inducing interests. And it's nice. It gives you fewer unpleasant stimuli when you log in. So you are less likely to treat it as a really bad habit and more likely to treat it as just this occasional fun indulgence. So yeah, that is annoyingly the solution to moderation problems is bread and circuses. And if you want to hash those issues out, you probably want to do it in person, or you want to do it in long form. You know, you can definitely have fun political arguments just with these voluminous email threads where you write 2,000 words on X and someone else writes 3,000 words on not X and you have a really good time. But it's a lot healthier to do that with someone you actually know and respect, because if you don't know them, you will eventually just develop contempt for them. They will develop contempt for you. Everyone will have a really bad interaction and it won't be fun for anyone.
Yeah. Remember people were lamenting filter bubbles, but maybe it turns out.
No, I wrote a piece a long time ago on how filter bubbles are great. And part of it was, I think you can extend the filter bubble concept to smaller things than just culture war stuff. And you can describe every startup, for example, as a filter bubble, where you take the tiny subset of people who think this is a viable idea and worth spending their time on, and you have them all work together. You make sure they work so long that they literally don't have time to get much exposure to the outside world and to the conventional view that this idea is just not going to work. And then you have a filter bubble where you are actually reducing that group's ability to seek truth. But what you are increasing as the trade-off is their ability to take seriously a given hypothesis and see how far they can stretch it. And that's really, that is probably something there's a larger shortage of, that there's like a lot of even fairly interesting centrist thought that is like, where can we find the best ideas from both sides, whether it's a political question or a business question or, you know, any kind of question. But A lot of the progress comes from someone saying, no, I'm actually going to completely ignore the other side. In fact, I'm going to forget the other side even exists. Like, if you, you know, if you had talked to someone at OpenAI in 2019, like, they would have spent a lot less of their time socializing with people who don't think that AI is possible, happening in, you know, the realistic, meaningful future, and the most important thing that any human being could work on either building or preventing being built the wrong way. And that's a good filter bubble to have. Like, if you actually want to develop AI, you want to surround yourself by people who think it's possible, and you want to minimize the amount of frictional conversations with people who just think this is not really possible. Like, there's just no way that if you create a big enough matrix, it somehow learns to write poetry. And then it turned out, yeah, matrices can write poetry. It's not great poetry, but it's poetry.
Well said. I want to segue into another piece you wrote about when you talked about how AI will increase ad load. Why don't you unpack that?
Yeah. So the analogy I would draw is to the early 2010s debate on the future of Google and Facebook business. Because for a while, there was actually this pretty popular, fairly mainstream in financial circles view that as these companies, as users move to mobile, ad revenue would plummet. That it's hard to pay for stuff on mobile, and the devices are slow, the screens are small, so you can't show great ads, and you potentially have, like, you can't use some of the data that you've collected on desktop to target things on mobile because it's a totally different context, and it's just not a relevant, it's not as relevant. So that was a meaningful fear for a lot of people for a long time. And it was, like, statistically true that in the case of Google, the cost per click for mobile was significantly lower than it was on desktop for a long time in almost every category. And on Facebook, they weren't really monetizing on mobile. I think at the time of the IPO, they were not monetizing. And then soon after that, they flipped the switch. But it turns out that mobile actually has some really interesting advantages over desktop, one of which is, okay, the screens are small, but the pixel counts are actually pretty similar. And really, people just, they position a device so it is absorbing the center of their field of vision. So it actually doesn't matter. Like, you can have a big screen TV and you're across the room and you're watching it. You can have a laptop and it's on your desk and you're looking at it. You can have a phone. It's in front of your face. You're looking at it. You can even have, you know, your smart glasses or this, you know, wire that jacks directly into your optic nerve. Like, the size of the display is not what matters. It's, can you saturate all of the pixels that this person can absorb? And if so, it doesn't really matter what the actual form factor of the device is. So that was one piece. Another piece was that mobile actually had richer data in some ways and allowed the collection of richer data. So most commerce is offline. Most human activity, even if it's mediated online, it still happens offline. And so location data is actually this really revealing view of what people do. What do they like? If someone is always stopping by whatever the nearest taco joint is, you know that they are much more likely to respond to ads for tacos. If they stop by a car dealership, but your other data sources indicate that they did not actually buy a car, well, now you know that they are very much in the market for a car, so you should try to sell them cars. That doesn't really work if they're logging on to Facebook on desktop. I'm sure some fraction of people were, you know, going to the, like, they're waiting for the dealer to come back and tell them something, and they just log into Facebook on that, you know, on the local Wi-Fi or whatever. But, you know, for the most part, it's just easier for a mobile app to get lots of location-based touch points that tell you more about someone's life. They also tell you more about who they know, what their social network is. You know, it's Facebook is really good at doxing pseudonymous people who go to an event with you and have a phone in their pocket. You know, the next day you will see a picture of the person you talk to with their real name as one of your suggested contacts. So, and then those networks are also really valuable because people do sometimes buy things in clusters. This is, I think, one of, but not the only explanation for the occasional conspiracy theories about how the phone's mic is always on. It's listening to your conversations and targeting ads based on that. No, what's probably happening is that you met up with a friend, they happen to talk about some recent purchase they made. The fact that they made that purchase is something Facebook knows. Perhaps it saw that through, at the time saw it through the tracking pixel. Perhaps they were buying consumer spending data and then connecting that to the user behavior data. Like, there are various reasons that Facebook would know that your friend had made that purchase and would have a much higher prior that, or much higher posterior probability that you are in the market for the same product and would thus show you the ad for the exact thing that, that you talked about. So that's the mobile analog is it turns out there's more data and it turns out there are more places to put ads. But I think with AI, what people are underestimating is just how much a text-based interface can steer a conversation towards the most commercial opportunity that does not turn the user off and make them feel like they're being sold to. So if you think of someone who is really good at sales or just really aggressive at sales, they will find a way to figure out if you have life insurance and if you've ever thought about buying life insurance or if you have a CRM for your company or have you thought about buying a CRM. Like, they tend to be reasonably good at steering casual conversations in the direction that can monetize well. And if they have a lot more data and they also have just a lot more opportunities to interact with you, they have a lot of chances to steer the conversation in that direction. So my guess is that as search shifts from like you type in words and you get answers that are based directly off of text that was on the web towards you get an answer that's generated on the fly, like that answer can persistently figure out what it is that will get you to spend more money and can also figure out where you could be like gently nudged, pushed in a slightly more monetizable direction, etc. Again, without being turned off. But I think the without being turned off criterion gets really interesting because people tend to be pretty sensitive to new ad units and to like ad load changes, but very gradual changes in ad load tend just to not be that noticeable. And so over time, it can go higher and higher and higher without actually irritating people, especially because in a lot of contexts, the ads have some convergence with whatever the natural medium of the content is. So if you're running ads on Instagram, you probably don't like write some really good copy, screenshot it, and then make an ad with that. No, you probably do something like take a really, really cool picture of your product. And if you're marketing on Instagram, you probably want to market a product that actually looks good in photos. If you're marketing in video, you probably want to market things that are where the appeal is more obvious if you can actually demonstrate the product. And if you're marketing in search or you're sending email to promote something, then yeah, you want to use a more text heavy format. You don't want people to have this constant whiplash across formats. But AI is kind of this, in some ways, it's like the post interface where it can be whatever format is the right format at that moment. And that means that you can actually have these ads that just go through constant permutations where it's sort of the whatever platonic structure created this 30-second pre-roll ad gets transmuted into the same pitch, but in text form in line in a conversation you're having with the AI. But yeah, long story short, I think that perhaps not in terms of literally ads seen per minute, but probably in terms of dollar spending mediated by ads per minute of use, that AI will actually be significantly better than other kinds of advertising. And I'm not sure who the winner is there. This is the first time in a while that people have been talking seriously about Google getting disrupted in search. On the other hand, Bing market share didn't really change. And nothing really changed that much. And of course, like those market share shifts can be invisible. If it turns out that everyone is like that Perplexity is growing like crazy and that more and more people are shifting, you know, if Perplexity goes from 1 basis point of share in search to 2 basis points, that doesn't show up in Google's market share. But if they keep on doubling their share, it's pretty visible pretty fast. But Google is perfectly aware of that. You know, I would imagine that the vast majority of Perplexity users are using it through Chrome. And I'm sure that people at Google are very regularly getting reports on how long are sessions on these Google alternatives that use AI and what kinds of things do people ask them instead of Google. And I suspect if they really want to win, then the thing that they're modeling is, at what point does someone switch from Googling to get the answer to using Perplexity or ChatGPT or some other service? And I think that is the point at which the PM in charge of that particular element of Google search, or a PM working on Gemini in search gets told that this is actually a problem, like this is a bug and it needs to be fixed, because Google has just amazing distribution for the task of, I have a question, I know the answer exists, get me the answer as quickly and seamlessly as possible. That is a really tough to disrupt advantage. The fact that their name is a verb is unbeatable. And you can't have two brand names as verbs for the same thing. So we will, even if Google dies, we will probably still be using the term Googled it to refer to whatever it is that comes next. But my guess is that what comes next is just Gemini as inline search results for Google, and that the search process does change over time, but in a pretty gradual kind of seamless way.
I want to segue to another piece you wrote about, going back to just big, or staying in our topic of big platforms, the economics of Facebook Marketplace.
Yeah. So this is a fun one. So you can split e-commerce into the people who try to generate and funnel demand, and then the people who try to satisfy that demand by actually selling a product. And there has been historically a pretty clear division of labor. So if you are writing a blog that monetizes with Amazon affiliate links, then you are a marketing advertising person. That's your part of the value chain. And then if you're Amazon, you're not a marketing and advertising person. Your job is to ship the product to the user. But those distinctions do tend to bleed into each other over time. So there are some sites where they started out as just, we're going to write content, we're going to monetize it through just display ads or membership or whatever. And then they did realize that affiliate links could be a very valuable tool for actually capturing more of that demand. They're sort of going deeper into the funnel. And it actually ties into the AI thing, the AI monetization thing of, if you are making money per click from a purchase, then your incentive is not just, hey, we're going to talk about highly monetizable topics, but it is more like, we're going to talk about why you should buy this specific thing. So Wirecutter is the classic example, where it is a review site that monetizes through affiliate links. And that model seems to work pretty well. Like they do get search traffic from people who are searching for best office chair or whatever. And then they want to steer them in the direction of whatever chair is actually going to fit their needs. And then they get a little cut of that. So they're closer to e-commerce, maybe in the sense of, you could imagine someone who worked at an e-commerce site whose job duties and job description were absolutely identical to that of someone who worked at Wirecutter, with just a slightly different monetization layer of, if you work for officechairs.com and you're in charge of their blog, then you're basically writing a Wirecutter piece. It's just only about things in your inventory. So there is, that distinction blurs on that end of marketing, kind of bleeds into e-commerce after a while. But it also blurs in the other direction of, Amazon has famously increased its ad load over time. And that means that if you look at the economics of their retail business, it's really, they sell products at break even in order to sell ads at 90% gross margin. And that's been a really, really good business for them, because it basically means that people are bidding their own gross margin to get whatever customer they should be getting for their product. And it makes it much more efficient for Amazon to extract whatever surplus those merchants would be otherwise earning themselves. With Facebook, what's really interesting is that they've sort of inverted it, because the way you usually think about this is that ads, just generic ad supported stuff, gets very low revenue per viewer, but gets a ton of viewers. And then if it is affiliate supported, like affiliate link based marketing, you get far fewer people, but it's usually people who have searched for exactly what you're looking for, or exactly what you're talking about. And so they monetize a lot better. And then if you are actually selling the office chair on your website, you get much less traffic than that. You generally have to pay for that traffic, but it is basically all from people who want to buy the product. So the monetization goes up as you get closer to the sale. But in the case of Facebook Marketplace, they do theoretically monetize it. You can actually pay to promote your stuff there. But like, I had to Google around to see if that was still true. Because when I look at Facebook Marketplace, I just didn't see anything that was listed as an ad. Maybe the ad marking is just really subtle. But what Marketplace does is it actually gives people one more reason to log into the site. And the purchases that they're making, they're usually pretty small dollar value purchases. There's actually a lot of time friction involved. But that also means that using Facebook Marketplace means spending more time on Facebook. And they used to have Facebook Marketplace as one of these bottom navigation buttons, and they actually moved it away. So you could still get to it in two taps instead of one, but it's slightly less convenient. And one reason for that, I think, is that now if you are trying to use Facebook Marketplace, you open the Facebook app and the first thing you see is your newsfeed. And so they actually have this one really brief instant where they can try to capture your attention with something other than Marketplace. And if they capture your attention, if you start scrolling instead of tapping to get to Facebook Marketplace, they could show you ads. And those ads do actually monetize quite well. So it is ironically an e-commerce business that is probably run at less than its maximum revenue and less than its optimal margin in order to subsidize a more lucrative ads business. So on the ad side, Facebook can actually, they can identify all of the products that you could conceivably want, and they can figure out, you know, is this the right time to sell you this thing or this other thing? They can do some level of retargeting, et cetera. A lot of that Marketplace is just not especially well equipped to do. You can't make your users on Marketplace, you know, upload 50 fields of metadata and then, you know, connect their marketing systems to the Facebook system in order to retarget all of their friends of friends, or, you know, retarget someone they met at a at a church picnic 2 years ago or whatever. Like, you can't really make individual people do that, but you can make a Shopify seller do pretty much the equivalent of, you give us as much data as possible, because every additional data point you give us allows us to run better targeted ads that are cheaper for you and more likely to perform well, and therefore you win. So it is this interesting testament to the power of centralized institutions versus totally decentralized ones. So Facebook Marketplace, it is decentralized commerce. Like, you are actually you're managing the inventory. If you're selling something, you're managing the inventory. Like, you have the blender you want to get rid of. It's in your house somewhere. You are coordinating with the customer, someone is managing logistics, either you are dropping it off, or much, much more likely, someone is coming by to pick it up. So like, it is totally decentralized. No one has to rely on third parties for anything other than this high level lead generation of, are you in the market for this thing I have or not? But, and it's just not as profitable to Facebook as selling ads for centralized e-commerce, where there's a company and there's an org chart and they have this separation of responsibilities, and they actually presumably outsource most of their stuff to other companies. So, you know, if you're a Shopify seller, you've basically outsourced most of your software and probably your payments to Shopify. You're not doing it in-house. So it is this testament to how the economies of scale from doing this well, like doing something really well, focusing on just that one thing, getting it absolutely right, and then growing it as much as you can possibly grow it, that those do tend to beat the economics of totally decentralized systems.
Yeah, that's an interesting takeaway. I want to segue away from our topic of big platforms and focus on a couple other pieces you wrote. One was about measuring inflation in a world of shrinkflation and price discrimination. Why don't you unpack
that? Yeah. So there's, people notice shrinkflation. No one likes shrinkflation. And one thing that people speculate about is, if shrinkflation is happening, does this mean that we're mismeasuring inflation? So if the cereal box used to be $5 and it's still $5, but it's 5% smaller, does that mean cereal inflation was zero because the box hasn't changed in price? And it turns out, actually, amazingly, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is actually totally aware of this, and they are pretty good at figuring out what's going on. So they look at the unit count for products. They look at the weight, or, you know, number of candies in the bag, or the volume, or things like that. And when they're measuring inflation, they are trying to measure that, because companies are constantly changing the size of packaging, and you'd never be able to track inflation reasonably if every time the toilet paper industry decided to go from 15 rolls in a container to 18 rolls in a container, if that just totally threw off your metrics, yeah, inflation would be very, very hard to measure. So they're actually aware of that. And not only do they track that, but they actually track how often it happens in the aggregate. And so there was this really interesting blog post from the BLS talking about CPI calculations, and they show where they counted the most, like what the trends in shrinkflation were. And what they actually showed was that peak shrinkflation was in the mid 2010s. Shrinkflation has yet, on a monthly basis, based on their survey, I think 10,000 or 100,000 prices, we have yet to have a month that had as many shrinkflationary changes as January or February of 2020 since then. And that actually makes perfect sense, because you do shrinkflation when you want to raise prices, but you can't just change the price. And so you don't need to do shrinkflation when there are constant headlines about a high CPI, when gas prices are high and people are complaining. At that point, you just say, it used to be $2, now it's $2.25. Deal with it. Like, everything else is getting expensive. This thing is getting expensive too. It's only when the thing has been $2 for a decade and you actually want to increase your margins and you know that if the price went up, customers would ask, what's the deal? Like, there isn't any inflation right now. Why are you trying to charge me more? Well, you can just give them less instead, and some of them will be annoyed, but many of them will just not notice and not care. Another driver of shrinkflation is actually that there are certain price points that convert better. And so there are some retailers that build out their plans by figuring out product category and price point. You know, is it a hat? It's a $5 hat or a $12 hat or a $20 hat. And then they back into what should it look like, what should it be made of, et cetera, from those price points. And so that does mean that I guess measuring hat inflation in that regime is actually really tough, because you basically have to figure out what the quality change has been. And, you know, maybe you can impute some kind of quality change from looking at the price of used products, but for some products, people just don't buy them used very much. So you can't really figure out much of that. But like, the main thing is that the kind of shrinkflation people talk about is typically the kind they can measure. It is, this soda used to come in an 8-ounce can and now it's a 6-ounce can or whatever. I guess those are small soda cans, but whatever. But those are the ones you can talk about, where you can demonstrate that this product stayed at the same price and got smaller, are also the ones that are pretty trivial to measure and incorporate into the CPI. So shrinkflation, it does have an impact on consumer experience. It is really annoying to buy the thing you've always bought and find out that suddenly you're actually buying a slightly worse thing for the amount you're used to paying. But it's not going to create a big wedge between what the CPI actually is and what inflation people are objectively experiencing. And price discrimination has similar issues, where if Wendy's is doing dynamic pricing and the cost of nuggets is going to react to supply and demand, that maybe makes things trickier. On the other hand, it's existed for a really long time. Matinee shows, senior pricing, et cetera, these things have been around for a very, very long time, and we've generally been able to incorporate them. Like, you can survey people on their spending, figure out what their spending looks like from that and what total consumption is, and kind of back into what is the blended price that people are typically paying. But where this gets interesting to me is on inflation narratives, and in particular on how inflation is experienced differently by people who are extremely online. So if you are spending a lot of time on Twitter and you're tweeting about your opinions and on what's going on in the world, you are pretty likely, I suspect, to be a disproportionate user of DoorDash, Uber, other services like that. You're probably more likely, if you eat fast food in a fast food restaurant, more likely to have ordered it on the app or have at least checked the app, et cetera. And so you are actually more likely to get price discriminated. And that means that your personal experience is going to be that companies are changing prices all the time. They are changing prices in ways that typically manipulate you into spending more. You know, when you are doing your order on DoorDash, it feels very easy to say, well, of course I want that extra appetizer. Of course I'm ordering a drink with this. And then when you actually get your bill, you do feel like that's actually, $30 for lunch. That's pretty steep. That's not what I'm used to paying. But it is because they are very much optimizing for you to spend more money than you originally intended to spend by showing you things that you didn't realize you could get for that price and that you do turn out to want. So people who are very online, who contribute more to the discourse, are more likely to just have the subjective experience of inflation being higher. But it's more that they are actually consuming things like extra food at lunch, and also the work of someone who brings the lunch to their office so they don't have to get up from their chair. That's just higher spending that they're doing that feels like inflation, but is actually just spending. I think a useful side note on this is there are lots of viral Twitter stories about just shocking levels of inflation in particular products. I haven't actually seen any of them check out. So sometimes, someone will post about this and people will just be shocked. And then sometimes someone will post about, how much money they spent on McDonald's this year versus 5 years ago. And someone will look up the menu and be like, you went to the Times Square McDonald's. It was a tourist trap. And you 5 years ago, you were living in this little college town. So of course, fast food was cheaper in a cheap place to live. Or And there was one that was talking about how expensive breakfast is in New York, and it was like breakfast at a hotel, again, near Times Square. So like a lot of these stories, they just aren't actually true, or they have stripped away the relevant details that explain most of the phenomenon. And obviously inflation is up from where it used to be. It is higher than it should be. That is bad, but there's no particular reason to try to engineer some view that the CPI has actually been going up 20% a year for the last 5 years when it's just plainly bad that it's been going up, you know, mid-single digits or higher over that time period. And that's not good. It is coming down now. So there is that. And we'll see what that does to the discourse. I kind of suspect that if inflation moderates and the economy is still doing well, that there are actually more opportunities for price discrimination. So if wages are generally rising, there is a larger incentive. There's just a bigger reward to capture from getting slightly better at getting people to spend slightly more. So my guess is that the inflation is out of control discourse will actually continue just fine. And in fact, will perhaps be enlivened by the growing gap between what the CPI says and what the median Vox writer experiences in their life. So once it actually becomes this thing where there's an in-group and an out-group, there's like, you know, inflation truthers and whatever else, I think at that point, then people get kind of locked in and will continue to dig in their heels in both directions. So like I firmly expect that if inflation starts rising again, you will have this cohort of people who say it's actually not rising that fast and you're still doing fine, and you know, ignore those numbers because things are getting better in other ways. So yeah, it'll basically continue indefinitely. All we can hope for is bread and circuses from our moderation overlords who know that we, even if we think we like arguing about how high inflation is, we actually don't like how much time we spend arguing about it, and we should be strongly discouraged algorithmically from ever thinking about it again.
I want to make sure we get into one other last topic you wrote about, which is this idea of marking to market, but more specifically in the piece around Social Security's future liabilities and taxes.
If I actually ran for office as a single issue candidate, or if I got involved in politics as a single issue voter, my big policy prescription would be more things should be marked to market. There should be fewer debates that are fundamentally debates about accounting terminology, and more debates over, is this worth how much we have to pay for it? And the only way that you can even start to have that debate is to actually figure out how much are we paying for it? And then, you know, maybe figure out what it's worth, but that becomes a more subjective question. So with Social Security, there is the contour of one of the debates on Social Security is that one group will say it is more like a pension, like you put money in, there's a trust fund, that trust fund has assets, those assets are going to earn income, and then eventually you take money out. And that money is the money that you've put in plus compound interest, and you get it back. And then the counter argument is, no, the trust fund is just an accounting thing. It is just the government saying this part of the government owes this part of the government enough money to pay these benefits. And the money is all going to the same people. It's all in the same place. Like there's no fundamental difference. There is probably some kind of logistical difference. And there are probably some things that you could do to one set of funds you couldn't do to this other set of funds or whatever. But it fundamentally doesn't make that big a difference. So in that sense, Social Security is a pay-as-you-go system. You have workers who are making money now. They pay taxes on it. They pay money to people who used to work who no longer pay taxes and do receive Social Security. And that system always looks a little bit dicey. On the other hand, like, you know, most of us have a sort of pay as you go life where we don't have enough money to just stop working forever. We tend to have to actually have some kind of income to pay for the stuff that we want to have. So in that sense, pay as you go is actually this very well established system. But let's set that aside and say that Social Security is not pay as you go. There is actually a fund that backs it, but that fund's asset is not marked on the books anywhere because the actual asset of that fund is the future tax receipts. And those future tax receipts are just analogous to any other financial asset that entitles you to some stream of cash flows. So you could just as easily argue that, I don't know, the corporate pension at Delta Airlines, it's a pay-as-you-go system because they have all these workers and, you know, they have these assets, but the assets maybe only produce like 7% a year. So if that 7% a year is the actual income coming in, the other stuff is just like, it's the right to future income, but it's not income right now. And the reason we would say that's not pay as you go is that you can actually dispose of that, those assets, and you can see what their market value is. So if it turned out that the pension had $5 billion of liabilities and $2.5 billion of assets, you could say, yeah, a retired pilot should actually be pretty nervous about this. They should try to figure out what's going to happen when the pension fund runs out. But if it's $5 billion in liabilities, $5 billion in assets, and the parent company is making money and doesn't want the pension to default, then you have significantly less to worry about. So how do we actually make it so that Social Security has assets? One proposal for a while was we should just invest the money as it comes in, because Social Security, you know, for most of U.S. history, it has been running a surplus. It can take in more money than it spends, because we have a large working age population and we had historically a comparatively smaller set of retirees. But as more people retire, as population growth slows, as healthcare improves and lifestyles improve and people live longer, you do end up with this unbalanced system. And so my proposal was just, Social Security should auction off 1% of the proceeds of payroll taxes for every year from now until the last person who is currently paying into Social Security will stop working and stop paying in. And then every year we just extend that 1 year forward. And so what we're doing there is we're trying to put a market price, just a market value on what do we expect those receipts to be. And then you can sum up the value of all of those future receipts. And you say, here is the present value of the future cash flows to Social Security. And then the liabilities question, like in theory, we could privatize some of the liabilities. In theory, you could require the government to go to some, you know, go to Lloyd's of London or some other consortium of life insurance companies and say, okay, how much would we have to pay you in order to create this portfolio of annuities paying, you know, 1% of everyone's Social Security? So you could actually mark the liabilities to market, but actually actuarially, like the actuarial stuff is pretty straightforward. Like you have one of the biggest sample sizes on Earth when you're looking at the population of Social Security recipients. You will have exogenous shocks, stuff like COVID, but in general, you can calculate those liabilities pretty straightforwardly. And life expectancy, it does change over time, but it does change at a pretty glacial pace. Like usually the shocks to life expectancy are going to be the bad ones. So COVID was like a life expectancy shock. Like there's a step function change and it's because people died sooner. There isn't like a reverse COVID thing where something happens and suddenly everyone's expected to live 5 years longer. That, you know, maybe Ozempic eventually becomes that, but even something like Ozempic, like, I haven't seen anyone write it, like make any claim that GLP-1 agonists have actually materially increased life expectancy over time. It is entirely possible that they will. My guess is that will actually be pretty complicated to calculate the economic impact there, because you'd also have to look at, will people be more productive if there's less obesity? Will we spend less money on healthcare and therefore more money on other things? Lots of complicating factors. I wouldn't want to make a definitive claim about the net effect of Ozempic on the solvency of Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, right now, but my guess is probably net good. Anyhow, so if we have this, if we have a way to mark the asset to market, you can actually look at whether Social Security is overfunded or underfunded. And if you're selling the rights to individual years of returns, you can also use that to either measure when people expect Social Security taxes to change or even to speculate on those changes. So it does create an interesting de facto policy market where if the curve of future returns shows some jump in the year 2025, the implication is market consensus is that payroll taxes are going up in 2025. So it's actually useful from a transparency perspective because it tells you more about the economics of what the government is doing. And that brings me to the real reason to care about this stuff, which is that it is very depressing to think you're debating economics and to turn out to be debating accounting. And a lot of discussions about optimal policy as it affects economics turn out to be more about accounting than about economics. And so we should think about what is the actual promise of Social Security. It is really a promise of delivering a certain standard of living, a certain basket of goods and services to a set of people over time. And the actual cost of Social Security is not really the taxes per se. It is that those those goods and services are diverted from whatever other purpose they would be put to. The productive capacity to create them is not creating other things, it's creating those instead. That is actually the cost of any government policy. It is, what do people do differently in response to that policy? What do they make that they wouldn't otherwise make? What do they not make that they otherwise would have made? And that is harder. It is fundamentally harder to measure, but it is what we're actually talking about when we talk about the cost of these things. So when you say that, if someone says Social Security is unsustainable, for example, if they're just saying that, you know, the net present value of current payroll taxes and, you know, expected future income is less than the net present value of the liability of current and future Social Security recipients, like that can be true, but I strongly suspect, given that voter turnout for older voters is literally 2x what it is for the youngest cohort of voters, like checks are not going to bounce. What actually happens is younger people maybe do just pay more in taxes, but possibly taxes don't change. And what actually changes is that inflation goes up because the government accepts a larger budget, because taxes are, in this scenario, more politically untenable than inflation. But it's either way, what is actually fundamentally happening is that resources are being reallocated in some way, and that way it could be good or bad, but just knowing whether or not it's worth doing it's very hard to do if you don't know what it costs. So that is my fundamental political view, is more things should have price tags on them so we can actually talk about what do they cost, rather than, you know, can we slightly tweak the numbers, game the numbers, et cetera, to pretend that they have some different cost than what they do.
With that, should we wrap on that one?
Sounds good to me.
Bern, as always, a great conversation, and I'll see you next week.
All right. Sounds good. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Riff. Please go follow and subscribe. Give us 5 stars. And check out Bern's excellent newsletter, The Diff, if you haven't already.